As a performer, songwriter, and producer, Richard Marx's nearly three-decade-long career has had innumerable highlights. He has sold more than 30 million albums nationwide, starting with his self-titled debut, which went to number 8 and spawned 4 top 5 singles, including the chart-topping Hold On to the Nights and Don't Mean Nothing, earning him a Grammy nomination. The follow-up, Repeat Offender, was even more successful, hitting number 1 and going quadruple platinum with 2 number 1 singles, Satisfied and Right Here Waiting.
Oceans apart, day after day, and I slowly go insane. I hear your voice on the line, but it doesn't stop the pain. If I see you next to never, then how can we say forever?
Richard Marx will be at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Friday night. That's February 19th, Friday night at 8 o'clock. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back Richard Marx to the Roundtable. Richard, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Are you the type of artist who is always on tour, or is your touring sporadic enough that it is special even to you when you're out doing it?
Wow. I don't know. I don't know that it's either. I think it's somewhere in between. You know, most of my career, I would tour to promote an album. So it would be a tour that would be, you know, called a certain thing, and it would have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then it would be like, okay, now I'm going to take a little break, and I'm going to write more songs, and I'm going to make a new album, and then we do it all again. And it was just a treadmill, you know, for years and years and years. And then over the last, I'd say, 10 years, I've done a whole lot less touring because I've put out a lot less music as an artist, but I've been writing and producing, you know, a ton of material for other people. And now when people say, are you on tour? I laugh and I go, no, I'm just doing shows. So I just go and play shows. I mean, it's not a designated tour. It's not really promoting anything. It's just going out and playing, you know, the songs that I've written for the last 30 years and continue to write, and visiting with the fans that have been with me all those years. You know, it's really that. It's not, it doesn't have a higher purpose than that.
So when you were at the Colonial Friday night, it is ultimately then, from what I'm hearing from you, because you want to be there. You enjoy that process of going from place to place and doing a show.
Yeah, I mean, the going from place to place is the lesser of the attraction of, you know, to me. I have a really beautiful life. You know, I'm not somebody that when I'm home, I yearn for the road and miss the roar of the crowd or anything. It's not that. And I've been very fortunate in that it's not a financial consideration. It's that I think it's important to maintain a presence as a performer. And when I am on that stage, I'm having the greatest time, because playing live for me, especially these last few years of doing this solo acoustic show, which is what we're doing there, I still love playing with the band, and I do sometimes, but the bulk of my shows now has been the solo acoustic thing, because it's relatively new for me. And it's so fun to just not have any planned, you know, I can do whatever I want. If somebody yells out a song, you know, hopefully it's one of mine, and hopefully I remember it, and I can just do it. And it's like, kind of like having everybody over to my house and just hanging out. And if there's a guitar there, I grab the guitar. Hey, let me tell you a story about it, when I wrote this song for NSYNC, or let me tell you about when I. And it's very conversational, and it's not a serious singer-songwriter show. It's just a great hang with, you know, with fans in a beautiful theater. And I'm just really grateful that I stumbled into doing these kind of shows, and it just makes the whole thing more fun for me, because it's not a grind. It's not like a typical tour. I'm just, you know, I go and play places that I want to play. You know, my agent sends me offers and I look at the venues, and sometimes I'll go, I don't want to play there. And a lot of times I'll go, wow, what a beautiful place, you know, or I remember playing there. Yeah, let's go back there. Or I've never been there. So it's all good. It's all just really fun for me.
What got you even thinking that you wanted to do an acoustic show? Because I would think that the intimacy would very much be a lure.
It is. I mean, I got to give credit to my agent who I just mentioned. His name is Terry Rhodes, and he's a veteran agent. He's been around a long time, and he's booked many artists. And he came to me a few years ago and said, he's from New Orleans. He said, yeah, I got an idea. How about you do a solo acoustic show? And I said, well, you know what? I've done those, like I've done like four or five songs at charity events when, you know, I want to contribute to the charity and show up for them, but I don't want them to have to spend a lot of money on travel and band and production. I've done it. I can do like four or five songs, but I don't know about a whole show like that. And he looked at me and said, oh, I understand. So you're saying that you're not talented enough to do a whole show like that. And he called me out. So I said, okay, fine. You know, book a weekend somewhere and let's try it. And if it's a disaster, we won't, you know, we'll know. And if it's fun, we'll look at continuing. And so we played down in Florida, I think it was, for the first weekend a few years ago. And I just had the most fun I've ever had on stage. And so that's it. And I've done this show, this solo acoustic show now in China and Southeast Asia and Europe and all over, even when in Russia, where, you know, they couldn't understand the jokes or the stories in between. And it's just been one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life.
For the audience member, what do they get from a song, especially like a rocking song like Don't Mean Nothing or Should Have Known Better?
Right.
Because it sounds different.
It sounds really different, but, you know, and I had to reinvent, especially Should Have Known Better, because it was, you know, people know that it was like the one of those quintessential 80s, you know, late 80s records, and very identifiable kind of production. But everybody knows that song. And everybody knows Don't Mean Nothing. And Don't Mean Nothing is easier because it's just, you know, I play it almost like the way I wrote it. And everybody's singing the dotted line, you know, behind with me. And Should Have Known Better is a big sing-along as well. These songs really do translate more easily than even I imagined they would. And there's even the rock songs, they work.
That idea of people singing along with you, is does that give you an incredible high? I mean, is it an enjoyable experience, especially because people actually know the words, but also because then you have that accompaniment?
Yeah, it's really amazing, especially whether it's the fun things like Should Have Known Better, where I just, you know, stop singing and let them sing the chorus, or in a case of like Right Here Waiting or Hold On to the Night, the ballads where the whole audience is singing every word. It's almost like Kumbaya. You know what I mean? At this point, I'm humbled by it, you know, cause these are songs that I just made up in my head one day. And now, you know, I can be in Indonesia and the room is singing every word of that thing I made up in my head that day years ago. And that is not lost on me. I am truly humbled by it. It's pretty amazing.
Lately, I mean, you've had success working with modern country artists, Keith Urban, Emerson Drive. How much of that has been a progression? And I would even think a natural progression.
I'd say very. All of it was a natural progression, but maybe even that's not accurate because I was doing it before I had success as an artist. You know, I started out as a songwriter and Kenny Rogers cut my songs and Philip Bailey from Earth, Wind & Fire cut one of my songs and Chicago cut one of my songs. So I had credits as a songwriter. I really wanted to get more into producing, which I did later on, obviously. And then my career took off and I was actually just saying in this last interview I did about how even in the middle of my first world tour on my first album, I had a 3-day break at some point. And I, instead of just, you know, sitting in by the pool or staying in bed and sleeping, I was in the studio producing a song I wrote for an all-girl metal band called Vixen. And that was in, 1987 or 88. So I just wanted to make as much music as possible and have it be as diverse as possible. I can't really get away with that as an artist. You had to kind of stick to not, I didn't ever want to do the same thing. And I think that there is, diversity in my recordings and my writing from myself, but nothing like being able to do a country song or produce a country record or an R&B thing. And over the last, especially the last dozen years, my work, my songwriting and production resume looks like Sybil. It's so schizophrenic. And that's the best thing for me, is I never get bored because every project is a little different.
What does it take? I mean, do you know the answers to questions like what it takes to make a good love song?
I know what it takes to make a good song. I know when I've written a good song. I don't know that anybody can determine what's a great song. It's all so subjective. And even a good song is all subjective. It's like that old line, there's only two kinds of music, good and bad. And if you like it, it's good. And if you don't like it, it's bad. Beyond that, no one knows anything. Clive Davis doesn't know anything. Bruno Mars doesn't know anything. McCartney doesn't know anything. We all just do music that pleases us. I mean, I know that there are some people that study it and try to contrive a hit. And they follow the patterns, or they study patterns and they follow formulas. And I just, that's never been of interest to me. But I've just made, like almost every other artist and songwriter I know who's been successful, we just did stuff that pleased us. It's all very selfish. It starts out as the most selfish exercise, sitting around and making up something that sounds good to me. And lyrically, once I tap into something, I'm still just purging, or I'm fleshing out, or I'm just writing, being creative for my own selfish purposes. But I also realize that we all have a bunch of stuff in common, all of us. And so if something really moves me emotionally that I've written, I know it's going to move other people too. It's pretty simple. It's a pretty simple concept.
Your first album comes out, it's a success, it's a hit, and then inevitably the sophomore slump comes, but that didn't happen with you. And do you have a sense as to why, and why you were able to sort of breeze through that?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, I was really aware of that term, sophomore jinx and sophomore slump, and I've seen, historically, as we all know, that's happened so many times, especially when you have a really big first album, as I did. I think that it was never a concern of mine or a consideration, and I think even in the moment I realized why, which is that even though I had what they say, you have your whole life to write your first album and only, 6 months to write your second album when it breaks, that wasn't the case with me, because I had been writing my whole life. But the songs are on my first album. I wrote all new songs once I got a record deal. There were maybe two songs from my past. Endless Summer Nights was one that I'd had for a few years and Should Have Known Better. And they were both big hits, but they'd also both been rejected by every record company, for years. And so once I got signed to EMI, I knew I wanted to cut those songs, but everything else, Don't Mean Nothing, Hold On to the Nights, the whole rest of the album was written that year. And so I knew what it was like to not write so much under pressure, but just to be always writing, to be constantly prolific. And so instead of it being a fearful experience for me when the first record blew up and I knew I had to make the next album, I couldn't have been more excited. Plus I'd been touring, so I knew the kind of songs I wanted for my live show, and I just had a better sense of the whole thing. So there was nothing about it that wasn't exciting. I couldn't wait to write those songs and make the next album. And then you get to a point where you have so much success or so many hits in a row that you do maybe start to second guess it. And I did that a little bit, and you start to go, well, maybe I should like Hazard, which was a huge hit for me, I almost didn't put it on the album because I thought it was just too different and too weird. Luckily, you know, there were people to convince me to put it on the record. And that was a great validation, too, because it encouraged me to be more diverse in the songwriting.
Richard Marx will be at the Colonial Theater Friday, February 19th at 8 o'clock. You can find out more information by going to berkshiretheatergroup.org. berkshiretheatergroup.org. The event is part of the 10x10 Upstreet Arts Festival at the Colonial Theater, Friday night, 8 o'clock, berkshiretheatergroup.org. Richard Marx, a great pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks very much, and have a great time in Pittsfield.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure.
Very nice to have you with us. Thank you. Again, Richard Marx at the Colonial Theater on February 19th, berkshiretheatergroup.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Just when I believed I couldn't ever want for more, this ever-changing world pushes me through another door. I saw you smile, and my mind could not erase the beauty of your face. Just for a while, won't you let give you something more, that I could be yours.